You ready, Steve? We're going to start. Good vach. We're beginning tape number 3. Sefer Derech Hashem of the Ramchal. We're holding in Ois Beis. We're continuing Baboyre Yisborach Shemoi information about Hashem. Oid Tzorach Sheyeda. We also need to know. Shehamotzui Hazeh Yisborach Shemoi. This being, this God. Ein amitas mitziyusoi musegas zulosoi klal. Nobody can conceptualize him. Nobody can understand God. V'rak zeh noidaboy. We only know one thing about him. Shehu motzui sholem b'chol minei shleimus. He is complete and perfect in all types of perfection. V'loi nimtzaboy chesorin klal. And he has no imperfections whatsoever. Now this includes no limitations. This includes no definitions. It includes no boundaries whatsoever. Now let's speak about this for a moment. The Ramchal is saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is complete. We know that. It says in Chazal, Hoyul hu nister b'tzad ha-hasaga she'enoi musug b'riya gemura al-kein hu shayrish v'ikir ha-amuna v'zeo tzadik v'amunasa yichya. HaKadosh Baruch Hu cannot be understood by anybody through human conception. And that's where we need Amunah. We discussed last week and 2 weeks ago the difference between Amunah, faith, and Yediyah, knowledge. Where we need Amunah is in areas that our knowledge cannot reach, and that is not in understanding that Hashem does exist, but rather understanding what Hashem is. Now, the Chovos HaLevavos and the Rambam have a very important principle for us on this topic. The Rambam writes that we know absolutely nothing about Hashem. It means not only do we not know about the totality of Hashem, what type of being, so to speak, Hashem is, but we know nothing even about the details of Hashem. Anything you'll say about Hashem is probably not going to be true. If you say Hashem is strong, or maybe you'll even say Hashem is the strongest one there is. Zatzapikursus. To say Hashem is Hashem is strong, or that Hashem is the strongest one there is, means that Hashem has strength. What is strength? Strength means the ability to overcome resistance. The difference between a person that can lift 200 pounds and a person that can lift 400 pounds is that the person that can lift 400 pounds can overcome more resistance. A person that can jump higher than another person is a person that can overcome gravity better. Strength means the ability to overcome resistance. There is no resistance to Hashem. In space, when you throw something, when there's no gravity, it makes no difference if you're throwing something that weighs 100 pounds or throwing something that weighs 2 pounds. It flies equally well because there's no resistance. To HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there is no resistance in the world. And not only is there no resistance, but there is no other source of strength either. When we say Hashem is the strongest one there is, that implies that there are other sources of strength in the world. Just Hashem possesses a quantitatively greater measure of strength than anything else. That's a lie. There is no other strength in the world besides Hashem. To state that Hashem is quantitatively greater or bigger or faster or stronger than any of his creations or than anything in the world is to imply a similarity between Hashem and the creations, and that's just not true. When we say Hashem is a gibor, it does not mean that Hashem has strength in the sense that we understand strength. When we say Hashem exists, it doesn't mean that he exists in the sense that we understand existence, and we'll explain this in a moment. The word strength, gevura, or chesed, or racha, or rachum, or chanun, mercy, or merciful, when we apply it to Hashem, is nothing but a homonym to the word mercy, or to the word strength, or to the word even in existence, when we apply it to anything else in the world. The Rambam says, and he was actually preceded by the Chovos HaLevavos, but everybody quotes this in the name of the Rambam, that when we say Hashem is strong, when we say anything about Hashem, these attributes that we assign to Hashem are not positive attributes. They are not toyarim chiyuviyim, but rather toyarim shliliyim. They're negative attributes. Meaning, we have no idea what Hashem is, but we do have an idea what Hashem is not. We know that Hashem is not physical. We know that Hashem is not weak. We know that Hashem is not cruel. We know that Hashem is not non-existent. And so, says the Rambam, when we say that Hashem is strong, that he's Gibor, we don't mean that he possesses strength. Rather, we mean that he is not weak. Strong in regard to Hashem, when we apply it to Hashem, only means the negation of the opposite. We mean Hashem is not weak. When we say Hashem exists, we mean that Hashem is not non-existent. When we say that Hashem is merciful, we just mean that Hashem is not cruel. Consider it as if somebody had a sixth sense. He was able to comprehend things with a different sense, something not one of the five that we know of. Obviously, he would not be able to explain it to us, because if you don't experience a sense, you can't understand it. You won't be able to explain to somebody who was blind all their life the difference between blue and red, or even the difference between light and dark. If somebody hasn't experienced a sense, he cannot understand it. You can't explain to somebody that never tasted the difference between sour and sweet what it is. And so, if there would be a sixth sense, it would not be explicable to us. But what we would know about the sixth sense is that it doesn't involve sight, it doesn't involve hearing, doesn't involve sound, it doesn't involve taste, it doesn't involve touch, feeling, and it doesn't involve smell. What it is, we don't know, but we know what it's not. Same thing about Hashem. If you want to explain to a blind person what it is like to see, you can't explain it to him, but you can remove any misconception he may have. You could say, look, this sense, this sight that we have, it doesn't involve hearing, it doesn't involve sound or touch or feel, taste or smell. At least we could remove any misconception. The most that we could understand about Hashem is to remove misconceptions. We understand what Hashem is not. By process of elimination, we come closer and closer, not to understanding what God is, but we go further and further from misunderstanding him. And that's the most we can accomplish in this world. All we know is what God is not. God is not like anything in this world. It's like a sixth sense, as a mashal, something we will never comprehend. But the best we can hope for is that we do not make a mistake and think that it belongs to one of the first five. Even when we say Hashem exists, it doesn't mean that he exists in the same sense that we do. And I'm going to explain this for a moment, and we're going to go to Ois Gimel in the Ramchal to understand this. Even though this is a bit further than where we're holding now, but it's relevant to understanding what we said, so we're going to do Ois Gimel. Ois Tzorech Sheyeda, we also have to know. Shamotzui hazeh yizbarach shemoi. Hinei metziyusoi metziyas muchrach. Sheefsher heodroi klal. Hashem's existence is a forced existence. It's an existence that must be. Not like our existence. We happen to exist. Theoretically, we could have not existed. Happens to be we exist. If we wouldn't exist, would that be a problem? If any individual in this world wouldn't be here, wouldn't be a problem. We happen to exist. God doesn't happen to exist, meaning he could have not existed, but we could prove his existence. That's not true. And God's not existing is an oxymoron. God existing is redundant. God, by definition, has to exist. A non-existent God, there's no such thing. The whole phrase is meaningless, just gibberish. And the reason for this is as follows. Every effect in the world has to have a cause. There's nothing in this world that happens without a cause. Everything has a reason why it happened. Even if you throw the dice and the dice ends on lands on the number six, there was a cause. It involved the force with which the die was thrown, the angle at which it landed, the material that it bounced on, and so on and so forth. There's a reason. It doesn't have to be a planned, designed reason, but there's a reason for everything that happens in this world. So now we have a philosophical question. If there's a cause for everything that happens in this world, that means the causes also have to have a cause. And the causes of the causes have to have a cause. Now, where does it start, asks the Rambam. You can't have an infinite amount of causes going backwards into time. That's absurd. It's absurd for numerous reasons that we'll explain later. But right now, suffice it to say that an infinite amount of anything in real life doesn't exist. You can't have an infinite quantity of anything. Not an infinite quantity of grains of sand, not an infinite quantity of moments in time. We live in a finite world. You can have a theoretical set of an infinite amount of numbers, but you cannot have an infinite amount or an infinite quantity of anything in real life. And you can't have an infinite amount of time, an infinite amount of causes, a regression of causes going back into time. There's no such thing. So there had to be a first cause, and that's God. But what this means is that God has no cause. I mean, God exists without a cause. Nothing causes God to exist. If you want to destroy something, you remove the cause of its existence. You want to kill something, you remove the cause of its life. Nothing causes God to exist means nothing can remove God. Nothing makes God God. A causeless God means that if you ask yourself, what makes you you? So you'll come up with numerous, whole roster of attributes and of aspects of yourself, and that makes you you. What makes a table a table? Well, the material it's made out of, the shape. What makes this table this table? Take all the things that make it a table, add to it its location, the point in time that it exists, and all of the above. Everything in this world has some cause that makes it what it is. At the very least, there are two. Everything in this world is comprised of form and substance. There's more reasons, but at the very least, there's form and substance. There's nothing in this world that exists without form or without substance. What makes you you? What makes a table a table? What makes a chair a chair? What makes a wall a wall? A rock a rock? Now, what makes Hashem Hashem? What makes God God? Now, a beginner, a well-meaning beginner, may say, well, his infinite strength, his infinite knowledge, his infinite lifespan, his immortality, all of this would be a lie. Because all this means is that there are causes, there are reasons for what makes God into God. It's not true. What makes God God? Nothing makes God God. What makes you you means that these components are there as a cause. The effect is you. To attribute to God certain aspects that make God God, what that means is that God has certain reasons for why he is what he is. But that's not true. God is causeless. God has no reasons for his existence at all. He's what we call mukhrach hametzius. The type of existence that God has, that exists not because of a reason, is something that we have never experienced in this world and that we cannot understand. Everything in this world has a reason. A causeless effect, a reasonless event, a reasonless object, a reasonless thing does not exist in the world. Our chushim, our senses have never experienced it. Our minds can't comprehend it, but that's God's existence. It's a totally different type of existence. If I have this sefer in my hand, it happens to be in my hand. Could have been, it wouldn't be in my hand. It happens to be in my hand. God doesn't happen to exist. It's not true that God happens to exist. God could not not exist. God's muchrach hametzius. That type of existence is something that we have not experienced. Everything happens to exist. If there's anything in this world that would not exist, it would not be a problem. So it wouldn't exist. People think when we prove the existence of God, we proved one of two options. Option one, God exists. Option two, he doesn't. We proved that he does. But if the proofs would have gone the other way, we would prove that he doesn't. It's not true. God, by definition, must exist. It's a different type of existence. So when we say God exists, we don't mean the same as our existence. It's a different concept altogether. It's nothing but hamonins. We say God is strong. We don't mean that God is strong in the sense that we are strong. It's just a homonym. We mean God is not weak. When we say God exists, we just mean that God is not non-existent. That's what Rambam says. That's what the Chayyus Halvava says. And the difference between two people, one is on a higher level of understanding of God, and the other one's on a lower level, the only difference is that the one on the higher level knows more about what God is not. There is nothing about God that we could comprehend. Not only can we not comprehend God in his totality, but we cannot comprehend anything about him. One of the reasons is because there is nothing. God is not comprised of things. Now, the Ralbag has a kasha on this. The Ralbag, in his Sefer Milchamos Hashem, disagrees with the Rambam, and he holds that these attributes of God are not negative attributes. They're positive attributes. They're just ambiguous. Meaning, they don't, clearly, when we say Hashem is strong, we don't mean the same type of strength as when we say a human being is strong, or we say a rhinoceros is strong, or we say a tree is strong. But it also doesn't mean nothing, like the Rambam says. He says, like, for instance, if you see a statue of a man, and you point to the hand on the statue and say, that's a hand. So you don't really mean it's literally a hand. You mean it's similar like a hand. When we say that Hashem is strong, and a human being is strong, there is a similarity in terms. They don't mean the same thing. But, Moshe l'mohadav adoimeh, like Hashem has a real hand, and we say that our strength is like similar to Hashem's strength. It really does mean something. According to the Rambam, these are what we call negative attributes or equivocal terms. According to the Ralbag, they're what we call ambiguous terms. And the Ralbag has a kasha on the Rambam. He says, I don't understand. According to the Rambam, you may as well say, first of all, that God has two heads. And I say, I don't mean he has two heads. I just mean he doesn't have three. You may as well say God has a body. I don't mean God has a body. I just mean that he's not a ghost. You may as well say that God has a nose, has one nose. I don't mean he has one nose. He just doesn't have two. So you can say anything about God. Why are we limiting it to only specific things? And secondly, he says, when we speak about God being perfect, like the Ramchal said, he's sholem b'chol minei shleimus. How do you know what perfection is? Maybe weakness is a perfection. If you don't know anything about God, how do you know what weakness is to say that God doesn't have weakness? The answer is, clearly, and the Rambam says it himself, in Mori Nevuchim, that we see what's considered perfection in us or what's considered weakness in us, and we project that perfection on God, or we project that lack of weakness on God, or the lack of what we perceive as a weakness on God. So says the Ralbag, you're out of business, Rambam. because you want to tell me that God is perfect. Then you're going to tell me that he doesn't have imperfections. And you're going to tell me, how do you know what an imperfection is? The benchmark that you're going to use, the gauge that you're going to use, is human imperfection. So then it's not true anymore that that the titles that we give God are just homonyms and they're meaningless, undefined terms, things that we don't understand or comprehend or know about. It's not true. There has to be some kind of connection. I'm not saying, Chas v'Shalom, says the Ralbag, that it's similar, there's any similarity between God and his creatures, but there has to be more than just homonyms. Homonyms is like pair of fruit and pair meaning two. One has mamish nothing to do with the other. If that's true, then all you're doing is playing word games when you say God isn't weak. God is perfect. What's perfection? Perfection is, mercy is perfection. We want to say God isn't cruel. That's very nice. But if you're not going to say that God has any connection to this perfection, then you're not saying anything. So I want to answer the Ralbag's kasha. We're going to answer it. And here's a question. When we say that God is wise, God is knowledgeable, God knows things, according to the Rambam, it just means that God is not ignorant. And we're assuming that knowledge is a perfection in people, and the Ralbag is saying that, therefore, it ought to be a perfection in God. Lack of knowledge is an imperfection in people, and lack of knowledge would be an imperfection in God. Certainly, his knowledge is not the same quality as our knowledge. It's not the same type of knowledge, but there is some positive attribute that we refer to as knowledge. So I have a question. It is true that knowledge is a perfection. Would knowledge be a perfection in somebody who's totally not ignorant? If somebody is not ignorant, would he need knowledge? Would knowledge be considered a perfection? Your body has the ability to heal. That's considered a perfection in you, right? Somebody who doesn't have the ability to be hurt, to him, the ability to heal is not a perfection. It's superfluous. It's useless. Somebody who is not weak, somebody against whom no resistance can be mustered, strength is not a perfection. You don't need it because you're not weak. Somebody who's not ignorant doesn't need knowledge because knowledge is just meant to overcome ignorance. The same way strength is meant to overcome resistance, to overcome weakness. So while it's true that we attribute all perfections to God, but we have to attribute them on the contrary. Not merely do we attribute them based on the benchmark, the gauge of what's considered a perfection in a human being, but also under the circumstances that it would be a perfection in a human being. And if a human being, even the Ralbag is moide, even if he's going to say that gevura, strength, God is strong, means some actual positive thing, has some actual meaning, the Ralbag is moide that God is also not ignorant. Those are two separate things. But once you say that God is not ignorant, then why does he need to be knowledgeable? So with the Rambam is miyushiv now, because the Rambam says that we don't attribute anything to God, even things that we consider perfections in ourselves, because God doesn't need any of our perfections. It's like saying, we have the ability to heal. Tell me, does God have the ability to heal? That's a perfection. The answer is no. What does he need it for? What does God need the clotting factor? What does God need it for? He can't get hurt. So what does God need strength for? God needs the ability to pick up 400 pounds or 400 pounds of resistance he can overcome. What is God? God is not weak, so why does he need strength? What does God need knowledge for? He's not ignorant. There are two separate things. God's perfections, and there's God's lack of imperfections. Once you establish the lack of imperfections, then all the perfections that the Ralbag wants God to proactively have, to have in a positive sense, are unnecessary and are no longer perfections at all. So now that's the difference also between saying that God is strong, meaning not weak, versus saying that God has two faces, means as opposed to three. When we say God is strong, we mean that God is able to accomplish in his way what we accomplish through strength. What we accomplish through strength, meaning the ability to do something, God accomplishes in His way. The only thing is that God doesn't really need strength to do things because He's not weak. We are weak, so we need strength. If we said that we have the ability to heal, God doesn't need it. And if we said that God has the ability to heal, it wouldn't really be true. So that's what the Rambam is saying. When you say God is strong, it's also not really true. But it does mean something. It means God is not weak, therefore He doesn't need strength. According to the Rambam, bottom line, Bekitzer, God is strong means He doesn't need strength. God is wise, meaning He doesn't need wisdom. God is knowledgeable, meaning God does not need knowledge. God is rachum, meaning God does not need mercy. God exists, meaning He does not need existence. He can exist without what we understand existence to be. He can do things without strength. He can know things without knowledge. So when we say that God is a gibor, God is yochel, God is motzui, we do mean something. We need that God. We mean that God does not need these attributes. That's what the Rambam means. The Rambam means that God does not need any of these. And it's not the same as saying that, well, God has a body. He's just really not a ghost. Because having a body is not a perfection over being a ghost. Having two faces is not a perfection over having none. What perfection are you attributing to God? We say God is strong. The perfection is God does not need strength. We need tools. We say that, well, you can go from place to place. You can access things. So God can also access things. Well, of course He can. That's a perfection to be able to access things, places and people and times. God doesn't need a car to do it. And when we say God is strong, it means He does not need strength. It's as simple as that. But to know about Hashem, even His existence is not really our existence. It's two different types of things. We know nothing about Hashem. This is what it means. We only know what Hashem is not. We don't know what Hashem has. We know what Hashem does not need. Let's continue. V'ulam, Devarim Eila Yedanum B'Kabbalah Min Ha'Avos U'Min Ha'Naviyim. These things that we are about to learn about Hashem, and all the things that are possible to know about Hashem, Klal Yisrael knows by tradition from the Avos and from the prophets. V'hisigum Kol Yisrael b'maimed Har Sinai. And all of Klal Yisrael understood them on Har Sinai. When Hashem said, Anoichi in lo yihi elecho, Klal Yisrael understood all the things that's possible to understand about Hashem. Va'omdu al amitosam b'beirur, and Klal Yisrael understood them clearly. V'limdum livnehem dor achar dor, and we taught them to our children generation after generation, kayoim hazeh, until this day. Shekein tziva Moshe Rabbeinu olav asholom ipi ha'gvura. Moshe Rabbeinu commanded them, pen tishkach es hadvorim asher ro'u einecha v'haydatam levanecha u'vilavnei vonecha. You should teach them to your children. You should know that there are shitas, the Maram Shik, and others, that the mitzvah of emuna is not to believe in Hashem, because as we said previously, there are objections to that. There are those that say it doesn't make any sense to have a mitzvah to believe in Hashem. Rather, the mitzvah is, according to these shitas, to transmit what you learned through Nevuah on Har Sinai and through the Avos generation after generation. Meaning it's not enough just to believe in God, you have to transmit to your children what you know about Hashem. That's really what the mitzvah of Emunah is, according to the Maram Shik. The Maram Shik holds, the Maram Shik has a parish on Tayag Mitzvahs. The Maram Shik says that the mitzvah of Emunah obligates us not to believe in God. There are reasons why that's not acceptable according to many shitas. The mitzvah of Emunah obligates us to teach our children everything we received by tradition about God that was originally known to us through Nevi'im and the Avos. We have traditions about Hashem that even if somebody believes in God, they won't know all these traditions. Some of them we've been discussing here. Yes, the average person in the street, he believes in God, that's fine, but all of these things about Hashem, he doesn't know. It's a mitzvah to give over this emunah to our children. When Klal Yisrael understood it on Har Sinai, they understood it. It obviously wasn't a mitzvah, they just, God gave it to them as a gift. The mitzvah was for them to teach that to their children and all the generations, to teach it to the future generations. Omnom. Gam mitzar ha-chakira. V'moifsim ha-limudiyim ye-omsu kol ha-inyonim ha-eleh. We can also prove these things about God. V'yuchach ha-yoysam kein, mikoyach ha-nimtsois, u-masigeyem asher anachnu royim be'ineinu. Through, we could prove these things about God through what we know about the world. Vaya al pi chokhmas ha-teva, ha-handosa, ha-techuna, v'shara chokhmas. Through science, through philosophy, through logic, we could prove these things about God. Shemehem tilokachno hakdomois amitiois. We're going to take first principles from these sciences. Ashe yivoled mehen beiru ha-nyonim ha-mitim ha-ele. That we really, really could arrive at these conclusions therefrom. V'omnom, however, loy narech ato bazeh. We're not going to spend much time on that. Ela natziha hakdomois la-mitom unesadur ha-dvar mal-buryom. We're just going to explain what our traditions are and what this information about Hashem is. We're not going to spend time on proofs. Now this is a reiteration of what it says in most Svarim. The Smag, when he discusses the mitzvah of Emunah, he says the same thing, that we can really prove it, but we don't really have a need to prove it. It's not much of a need, because Klal Yisrael all believe in God anyway. It's just a question of what our traditions are, what we are committed to believe. We're all committed. It's just a question of what we're committed to believe. Now, truth is, we live in a generation, unfortunately, where there's a big need for this. People are so confused, but clearly. We're going to go into it just a bit. Clearly. Any objective human being cannot come to any other conclusion besides that there is a HaKadosh Baruch Hu and he is all the things that we are saying about him. First, there are two types of proofs. There's the philosophical proofs and there's the simple mathematical proofs. Let's start with the mathematical. This comes from the Chovos Halvavos and other places too, but he is most famous for it. Everything in this world is one of two things. It's either intelligence or accident. Everything in this world is here either by accident, it's set up this way, it exists this way, it is this way, either by accident or by design. There's no third alternative. It's either accident or not accident. Not accident means on purpose, by design, right? Now, the world either came by accident or it came by design. If it came by design, that means it had a designer. If it came by accident, that means it did not necessarily have a designer. Question, could the world have come by accident? Well, the answer is, well, you decide for yourself. Let's see what we know about the world. If a person would go to the moon and he would find a spoon on the moon, what would his conclusion be? Somebody was here before me. What if it wasn't a spoon? What if it was a camcorder? You'd say, oh my gosh, I thought I was the first person on the moon. But obviously somebody was here first. Or if not somebody, somebody threw this out into space and it landed here. But would the person say that this camcorder came there by accident? That through millions and billions of years of happy accidents, the glass and the lenses formed themselves and the wires formed themselves and it produced itself just like that? What are the odds of that happening? Says the Chovos Halvavos. I'm paraphrasing him. If you put a monkey at a word processor, will he come out with the Encyclopedia Britannica? Will he come out with even one legible sentence? What are the odds? If you want, I'll tell you. I'll tell you what the odds are. But that he should come out with the Encyclopedia Britannica is absurd. You know, in a court of law, if you were on a jury, And it was a murder trial. And they said that they found the defendant's fingerprints on the murder victim's throat. And there are 10 witnesses that saw him strangle this man. Had no alibi, nothing. You'd find them guilty, right? He comes up and he says, you know what, witnesses can lie. And fingerprints? I want to tell you something about fingerprints. There is no scientific reason why two people can't have the same fingerprints. How could my thumb, when I'm born, know everybody else's fingerprints to avoid duplicating anybody? It makes no sense. Rather, the odds, there are so many possible different designs that a person can have on their fingers, that the odds of two people having the same fingerprints are so low that we consider it proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, or beyond a reasonable doubt. Same idea. The odds of a human eye coming by accident are so much lower than the odds of 10 people having the same fingerprints. You want to know a little about the human eye? Here's how it works. You have a camcorder. Can we know how a camcorder works, more or less? Light comes into your eye. First step is that there are these color sensors that fine-tune the color contrast and detail your vision. You know how many of these cone sensors there are? 7 million. 7 million of them. They're in your eye. They're all needed. They fine-tune the color. Maybe there's not enough light for these 7 million cone sensors to work. So then there are these backup black and white sensors in your eye. You know, like when you're in a real dark room, you can't really see colors. You can still see black and white. There are different sensors that do that. How many of that? There are 127 million of these cone sensors, these black and white sensors. In the meantime, there's some optic nerve in your eye. It receives the signal from those 127 million sensors, puts them into some kind of code, and shoots the code into your brain. And it can't happen all at once. I mean, you know, it's only a mechanism. How fast can this go? Per second, how many impulses get shot into your brain, coded by these 127 million sensors? Per second, 1 billion. 1 billion impulses per second go into your brain. Now, at the same time, simultaneously, when all this is happening, this black part of your eye, the pupil of your eye, it monitors how much light is coming in, how much light is not coming in. It gets bigger, it gets smaller. It maintains maximum image sharpness. There are all sorts of other mechanisms that are able to clarify the image. And that's nothing. Human eye is nothing. Your brain, compared to your brain, your eye is a spoon. There are nerve cells in your brain. 10 billion of them. Each one of these nerve cells have to communicate with each other. So they have these little fibers between the cells. Each cell, each one of these 10 billion cells, sprout between 10 and 100,000 fibers in order to communicate with the other ones. If you take the total amount of these connections in the human brain, they are 1 quadrillion. If you want to know what 1 quadrillion is, that's 1 with 15 zeros. Now, how much connections do you think that is? Like, what is that number, 1 with 15 zeros? Think you win the lottery on the odds of 1 quadrillion? If you want to know what 1 quadrillion is, Take like 1 million square miles of land. It's about half of the whole United States. Fill the entire 1 million square miles with a forest. Thick forest. Every square mile has 10,000 trees. Okay. Each tree will have 100,000 leaves. 10,000 trees per square mile. 1 million square miles. And on each tree there's 100,000 leaves. The total number of leaves in that forest would approximately equal the amount of connections in the human brain. You understand what this is? Now, this was either accident or intelligence. One of the two. There is no third alternative. If a person would find a camcorder on the moon, he would surely recognize the fact that somebody created it. The odds of this happening are beyond zero. It's like literally saying, you see, the Gans Shas with the Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos and the Mefarshim in the back, and say it accidentally came because somebody spilled some ink on a paper. But it didn't happen once. There are billions of years for this ink to spill on the paper. You put a monkey in a word processor and came up with Gans Shas. Makes absolutely no sense. Every cell in your body, besides numerous other things, it needs protein molecules. Millions of protein molecules in each cell. Now, what are the odds of even one of these protein molecules? Now, we're talking about the brain. We're talking about connections. One protein molecule. What are the odds of one protein molecule coming by accident? Well, here's how it works. If you take, and this is coming not from the Chayus Halvavus, this is from the scientists themselves. If you take a quantity of matter, amount of matter that equals to everything in the universe, the entire universe, shake it up and down trillions of times every second, it would take not 10 years to produce one protein molecule, simpler than any we know, but rather 10 to the power of 243 billion years. I mean, it'll never happen. It'll never happen. By accident, it can't happen. You ask an atheist. Atheist, I want to ask you something. You have a stomach, right? You eat meat, beef, hard meat, or maybe deer meat, right? Venison, real tough, thick stuff. You eat it, the acids in your stomach dissolve it right away. Sometimes a little more than right away, it takes a little more time. The acids in your stomach dissolve it. What's preventing the acids in your stomach from dissolving your stomach? Your stomach is only made out of meat, nothing else. So he'll tell you, well, what do you mean? There's a lining that the stomach has that immunizes the rest of the stomach from the acids. If there's a little chas v'sholom puncture in the lining, that's an ulcer. Now, as the human body was developing through millions and billions and trillions of years, which came first, the stomach or the lining? The acid or the lining? Which came first? How many millions of years would human beings survive before the lining in their stomach developed evolutionarily, if there is such a word? It's a pity that it even has a root. A poisonous snake. Why doesn't a poisonous snake poison itself? You know, poisonous snakes, they inject poison into people, and the people die. Well, the poisonous snakes have poison injected into themselves. Why don't they die? Well, they have a sac that prevents the poison from entering their system. Which came first, the poison or the sac? How did the snake know how to create this sac? By accident it came, or somebody told it? Hey, ever see a Venus flytrap? When I was a Bach in Yeshiva, we had a Venus flytrap. I don't tell you who owned it. He's a Rebbe today. But he owned a Venus flytrap, and it was very good. Until on Purim, he fed the Venus flytrap some wine, and that was the end. It was Yotzad Zalo Yod, I never woke up. But this Venus flytrap is an amazing thing. It sits there. It looks like a big open mouth with these big teeth. And inside the Venus flytrap, there's a little piece of nectar that's bait. And it knows what type of bait its victims like. If a lion or a tiger would come to eat the bait, it wouldn't work. But these little bugs, little flies come in. And once it enters, so there are three hair triggers. If any two of the three, a combination of any two of the three are tripped, then the Venus flytrap starts shutting, because a piece of dust can come in and trip one. But to trip all three is harder. A combination, any two of the three. Then it shuts. It has this perfectly made hinge. And it shuts and it digests itself, digests the victim, opens it up again and starts the... How does it know how to do this? You have a backyard. You have dandelions in your yard. You know why dandelions are yellow? Dandelions are yellow because they need to be pollinated by bees. Now, bees like yellow. If a dandelion was the same color as the grass, so the dandelion was a dull color, the bees wouldn't be attracted to it. Now, the bees come and attracted to the dandelion. It's yellow. And now, dandelion doesn't need the yellow anymore. So, guess what? It loses the yellow. Now it becomes, you see, ever see those puff balls that blow in the wind? That's what happens to the dandelion. So dandelion now becomes a puff ball. It doesn't need the color anymore, so now it's colorless. It's like this milky, ugly color. But it does need something else. It needs the wind. And it can't stay low down, like in the level of the rest of the grass anymore. So now, not before, only after it grows high above the rest of the grass. And it has these little paratroopers connected to it, these seeds. Many of these seeds, dozens of these seeds, connected by a string to this parachute-type mechanism that is connected to the flower, tight enough that it shouldn't just drop, but loose enough that a Ruach Metsuya should come blow it away. And the balance is such that it flies in the wind until it falls. The mechanics, the technology that's inside that seed, no matter what position the seed falls, it knows to shoot a root down into the ground and another plant up above the ground. Now, how does it know all of this? How does the plant know what colors and what the bees like and what the wind is like? And either by accident or somebody told it. I could go on. I could tell you all about the bat's sonar. And I could tell you how beetles recognize motion. I could tell you all about nature, but we mamish wouldn't get out of here. And the Ramchal says, "Loi naricha tabuzeh," and we're not going to go into this either. But anybody, atheist, a lunatic. You put an atheist on a trial. Just imagine being on a jury together with an atheist. And he says, "Whoa, the fingerprints were on the murder victim's throat." I'll say, "Aha." And you also believe that a human eye came by accident. So why can't you have two alike sets of fingerprints? You believe that, so why won't you believe that? Two snowflakes? Doesn't say anywhere that two snowflakes can't be alike. How does one snowflake know what all the other snowflakes look like? Just that the odds are so little, we assume it's impossible. The odds of this happening is so impossible that the world should come by accident. It's just anybody that lives is like you cross the street and you see a car three blocks away. Theoretically, one in a trillion, you can get hit. Maybe the guy will speed up by accident, but we live our life believing that after a certain amount of odds, it's already impossible. It's beyond a shadow of a doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt. Anybody that lives his life that's willing to cross the street, that's willing to walk out on the street and not worry that a meteorite is going to smash him right away, has no right to be an atheist. Because the odds of him walking on the street and being smashed by a meteor are a lot greater than this world coming by accident. It's totally inconsistent. That's all it is. It's inconsistent. The odds of this world coming by accident are mamish zero. That's all it is. It's like saying, you want no odds. Tell me, you throw a dice. A dice has six sides. If you are you hoping that the number three is going to fall on top, it's one in six, right? Now, if you throw it 15 times, what's the odds that the number three is going to fall on top every time? It's not 1 in 15. You've got to multiply times 15. If you want to know the number, I have it here. It's 1 in 470 billion, 904,984,576. Now, if you have one cell that has not six sides, not 15 parts, but millions and millions and millions of characteristics, each one of them have to be precisely made. It's like imagine taking a pair of dice that have not six sides, but thousands and hundreds of thousands of sides, and throwing them and betting on the odds that they will always come up for years and years and centuries, throw after throw, precisely in the right position. What kind of lunatic is going to? Those are proofs from nature. Then we have the philosophical proofs. As we said, all effects have to have causes. There's no such thing in the world as an effect without a cause, which means that there had to be a prime cause, as the Chovas HaLevavos points out, and I promised I would explain this later, well, now is later, that the world could not have existed forever. It's not possible to have an infinite progression of time that already took place before we are here today, because if that's true, we would never be here today. To say that the world has an infinite chain of causes in the past means that there was an infinite amount of time that already transpired before today. But that's not possible. Because of an infinite amount of time already transpired, we would never reach today. Can't happen. You can't say that the world has already experienced an infinite amount of time. That can't happen. So it had to have started somewhere. If it started somewhere, who started all the causes? Not only do you need a God, a prime cause, but that prime cause ends up causeless. And as we said before, that's infinite, that's all-powerful. Causeless means cannot change, cannot be destroyed. All the things we know about Hashem. Muchrach hametzius. You can't remove its cause. If you can't remove its cause, it has to be there. There's another proof from motion. Motion cannot start unless there is... It's similar to the first proof, but officially they make it into two. Motion cannot happen unless something in motion caused it. You can't animate something except through an animated object. If you want to throw a ball, you have to move your arm. If you want to move your arm, you have to actually do it. Something had to start all the motion from the beginning. Where's the beginning of the motion? Well, who was the prime mover, it's called? That had to be God. There's no question. There's no question to anybody that wants to know HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists. There's no suffix in the world. And then, of course, there's the history. The fact is that there's one religion and one religion only that makes the claim to a revelation that took place in front of millions of people. Let's say there are about 3 million people in the Midbar, 600,000 men between 20 and 60, so double that for the women, it's 1.2 million. Double that for the people on older or younger, let's say 2 point, somewhere around in the millions. Now, I have a question. If I were to make up a religion, and everybody agrees people did make up religions, mathematically, all the religions cannot be true. As a matter of fact, they can't all be, most of them can't be true. They cannot coexist. If one exists, it automatically negates the other. Now, if I was making up a religion, I wouldn't come and say, you know what, God came to Shapiro and told him, you know what, go tell the world that you are now the leader, you are now the prophet, everybody has to follow you. That's weak. I have a better story. God came to all my followers. God came to the whole city of Far Rockaway, the whole borough of Queens, at the very least the whole Bayswater, and said, go follow Shapiro. And you didn't know about this, but it came to your parents. So why not a single religion ever did that? Not a single one. Why? The answer is because it's ridiculous. Nobody would believe such a thing. They'd say, Shapiro, if this happened to millions of people, how come you're the only one that knows about it? How come you're the only one that knows this? That's why no religion could, not only no religion, there's no hoax in the world perpetrated that supposedly happened in front of millions of witnesses. There were, but they didn't last long. The UFOs landing in the world on the radio, immediately they were exposed to be fake. Because you cannot, such a lie can't wash. You cannot concoct millions of witnesses to an event and tell their truth. Now, David HaMelech was alive. When he was alive, it's clear, no atheist would disagree, the Jews believed in the Torah. There's a 400 years after Kabbalah's HaTorah, that's all it was. 100 years now, in the year, let's say, 1600, or the Common Era, it's not so long ago. Imagine if I were to tell you that your grandparents in the year 1600 got a revelation from God, and they all said these things, you know what, things that once every 7 years you should abandon your land, you know, you should just let nature take its course, a Shemitah, all these sacrifices, all these, I don't mean sacrifices, carbonus, I mean all these prices that you have to pay in order to fulfill the Torah. God came to you and said, who is going to believe this? There was one. There's a book, Permission to Believe, it's called, by Lawrence Kellerman. So he did research, and he found one religion that has such a story. Here's the story. I think it was some South American Indians. It's in a footnote in his book. Some South American Indians had this Krishna. Krishna was some kind of godling or something to that effect, who supposedly came to a group of warriors after a war, and like told them a whole bunch of things. Now, it's very interesting he came to all of them, because not a single one of these warriors survived. Not a single one did. One of them survived and came and told everybody, you know, everybody saw Krishna. That's it. That's the closest you're going to get. And by total coincidence, the only religion that claims this, also we were stubborn people. I'm Kshei Orif. There were so many people. We had people that deny Torah Shebal Peh. We had people that we had Nebuch, we had Christians, Tzedukim, we had Baisusim, we had all sorts of crazies throughout history. None of these people denied the revelation. None of them denied Kabbalah HaTorah. It was a historical fact. And by a coincidence, this same religion, the only religion that claims this massive revelation, also claims to have a history of the world from day one. These religions, the Buddhism, they don't claim to know what happened from the beginning of the world. We do. Imagine, we say the world's 5,700 some odd years old. That's terrifying. It's a blink of an eye. Imagine. If a few thousand years ago when we said the world is just a couple thousand years old, somebody would find some kind of civilization with a history of 10,000 years, be up the creek. But guess what? All the world is known. All the historical records are known. The furthest going back in history, let's say the Egyptians, about 4,000 years. And it takes about 1,000 or so years to start a civilization that big. Guess what? By coincidence, it works. By coincidence, that exact same religion also made scientific claims thousands of years ago without any way of knowing it. It's a Mishnah, a Masechta Nida, that everybody knows. A fish has two signs of kashrus. There's the scales and the fins. But the Mishnah says that there is no fish in the world that has scales that doesn't also have fins. Fins without scales, there are. Catfish, eels even. But scales without fins, there's no such fish. So if you see a fillet with scales, with the skin, you can assume the fish had fins, and you're allowed to eat it. It's kosher. Now, when they said it was a few thousand years ago, it's in a Mishnah. Nobody denies that. Now, since then, they discovered all sorts of crazy types of fish. There are fish that live so, the fish that eat people. There are fish that live so deep in the water there's no light, so they carry their own flashlights hanging on their own foreheads. There are fish, all sorts of crazy. Not a single fish was discovered that has scales without fins. These commitments that we made to the age of the world, to scientific facts, this was, by coincidence, it's the same religion that claims the revelation. There's no suffix for any objective human being as to what the reality is. This, plus the philosophical proofs, it's clear. All that's left for us to know is what our tradition was by Kabbalah HaTorah regarding HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, at this time, we're going to take questions. First, questions on the topic. If there are no questions, we'll go further. If there are, we'll take the questions, and then questions on anything. Anybody have any questions? Right. Right. We can. Here's a question. When we say that Hashem is strong, even though Hashem himself doesn't need strength, but the result of Hashem's actions are strong. Like, Biyad Chazaka, Kodesh Baruch Hu took Klal Yisrael out of Egypt. So why can we not say that the attributes of Hashem are understood in the sense that this is how they relate to us in this world? The Rambam says a similar thing. You can understand the attributes of Hashem in a different way, not referring to Hashem himself, but referring to Hashem's actions. Meaning, I'll give you a mashal. Let's say I tell you that heat burns. Now, let's say you see something that got burnt, but it wasn't through heat. It was through radiation. Or maybe it was through some other medium that we're not aware of. Maybe some other things cause burns that we don't know. We would still refer to the results of the burn, of the radiation as a burn. Even though it's not really attributable to heat, nevertheless, we would refer to it maybe as heat. Some people could call radiation heat. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't exert strength, but the results of Hashem's actions in this world sometimes are such that we normally attributes to the results of strength, to strength being exerted. So in such a case, we would say Hashem is Gibor. When we say Chesed, Hashem is Rachum V'Chanun, it means that because of Hashem, good things happen to people. Now, normally, we would say that that's the result of mercy. By Hashem, it's not. But kind of colloquially, as a figure of speech, we say that Hashem had mercy on these people. It doesn't refer to Hashem. The first pshat we had is, Rambam says both are possible. The first pshat we said is that it's referring to Hashem, and it doesn't mean something, it doesn't mean a positive thing about Hashem, it just means to negate the opposite. Here we're saying that it doesn't even refer to Hashem at all. It just refers to the aftermath of Hashem. It refers to the results of what Hashem does. The results of what Hashem does is mercy. We can call it like that. Well, yeah, but the Ralbag said he's disagreeing with the Rambam, and he saw that also in the Rambam that he's disagreeing with. But that's not what the Ralbag says. Ralbag wants to make the attribute refer to Hashem himself, not in a way that it's similar to us, but that's not the Ralbag. It's not the Ravag. No, that's the Rambam, not the Pshat. The result. Like, for instance, theoretically, a person could say, I don't know, let's say a volcano erupts. And one town didn't get wiped out. So somebody could make a statement, the volcano had mercy on this town. It doesn't mean the volcano really had mercy, but it means the result is what we normally attribute to mercy. So in that sense, we would say Hashem had mercy on this town. It's not really Rachmonis. But it's a result, and it results in what we would normally refer to as Rachmonis. But you have to understand that it also says, Biyad Chazaka, Hashem has no hand. Einei Hashem, Hashem has no eyes. All these things have to be understood the same way. To say that Hashem has emotions, literally, is the same as saying that Hashem has limbs, literally. And when we say that Yad HaChazaka doesn't really mean a hand, the Chozik Yad, or Einei Hashem doesn't mean physical eyes, Vayishma Hashem, Hashem heard, doesn't mean he has ears. So too, V'chara Af Hashem does not mean he really has anger. Hashem can't have emotions for numerous reasons. Number one, emotions are physical. Number two, emotions are attributes. And number three, emotions imply a change in a person. God is above time. Since God is above time, he cannot change. Emotions means today I'm in this mood and tomorrow I'm in that mood. Today I'm angry, tomorrow I'm not angry. That's a change. God doesn't change. Also, it implies a vulnerability in God. God getting angry means that something affected God. God is not affected by anything. Nothing you do can touch God. You can't impact on God. But if you say God really got angry, that means you impacted on God. You actually affected him. That's not reality. No, it doesn't apply to others, but when God does things, he doesn't do it through the medium of strength. He doesn't need the medium of strength. The results look like strength. No, but it's not saying anything about God. It's not anything. It's not an attribute. Maybe it has nothing to do with it. There's still, it has nothing to do with what we call strength. It's a totally different definition. Why are we calling it strength even? Only because it results in the same thing, but it may not be the same thing. The Ralbag is talking about what it is. Right. No, but not strength is needed. Strength isn't needed. Nothing's needed. In regard to God, it's not strength. It's not anything positive that you could identify. Right, there's no resistance, there's no need for strength. It's not strength. Even regarding his actions in this world, there's no need for strength. Why does he need strength? It's his world, he's the king. Nothing opposes him. Just, from our perspective, it looks like strength was exerted, so we say that. In the Sefer Derech Amuna, it says that since we know that nothing positive could be said about God, those first four of the 13 Ikrim, that discuss God, are really just Tayarim Shliliya, meaning the first one is that God exists, the first of the 13 Ikrim. All it means is not that he exists, it means that he does not exist. The second is Hashem's Achdus, that he's one. All it means is that he's not more, he's not two. The third one is that he's not physical. And the fourth one is that he was eternal, it's that there's no Hischadshus. He was not new, he did not appear. That's all it means. Now, this is very interesting because there's a famous Machloikis Rambam and Rivet in Hilchis Tshuva. The Rambam says that when the Torah mentions these things about Hashem, Hashem's eyes, Hashem's hands, the Hagishomo, these anthropomorphisms, they're of course not to be meant literally, and they don't mean. And anybody who says they mean literally, he's a apikiris. And the Ravid says, Rambam, how could you say such a thing? A lot of big tzaddikim believed this. He said, people even bigger, better than you, than the Rambam. Now, we all learned this, but can anybody here identify who these people are? These big tzaddikim who are bigger than the Rambam, or even close to the Rambam, that believe that God really has eyes? Who believed that? Who? The Gemara didn't believe that God really has eyes. Where does it say God has eyes? It doesn't matter. That means to imagine. It doesn't mean that's really God. You may as well blame the Navi Yecheskel by Maaseh Merkava. It doesn't mean literally. Nobody claims that. Who are the people? I want to know who committed himself. Which one of these tzaddikim committed himself that they believe that God has physical limbs? Who? So I think that the Ravid was talking about the Deya that says that God merely has positive attributes. Because according to the Rambam, if you believe that God has positive attributes, it's the exact same as believing that God has eyes or a nose. And those Rishonim and those that disagree with the Rambam and that believe that God has positive attributes, now the Bag was not around when the Rambam wrote that, but there are others that may be held similar, that God has positive attributes, whatever they may mean. According to the Rambam, if you believe that God has positive attributes, it's mamish the same as believing that God has eyes and noses. Yeah, okay. Right, no, there's no question God interfaces with the world, even though he's so far removed from it. In fact, that's the theme of the what we say in the morning, Adon Olam. The first half of Adon Olam speaks about Hashem having nothing to do with us. Hashem Molach, B'terem Kol Yitzir Nivra, he was king before everything was created, he's so high, he's Hoyohoy V'Yihiyeh, he's all of this. The second half of Adon Olam speaks about Hashem as Mamish right here with us. At the end, Hashem Li. He's for me, he's with me, he's mine, however you want to explain that. It's true. But the question is, he interfaces with the world and he does things in the world through a system. And as you mentioned, one of the components of the system is Lo Yireini Adam V'Choy. And it's interesting because the Rambam in Mori Nevuchim, when he discusses this, actually says that those two questions that Moshe asked Hashem involve the two aspects that we're discussing here. But it's true that Hashem interfaces with the world, but the question is, what medium is God using while he's interfacing? We know that he does something. He does action, and that there are results, and that those results come directly from him. Now, what medium is he using? Is it an emotion? What's motivating him? Emotions motivate people. Are emotions motivating God? The answer is no, it's not emotions that are motivating. What medium is he using? Is he using strength? It's not strength. Things are happening because God is making them happen. But making something happen doesn't say anything about the one that's making them happen. It says something about the subject, and the information you're getting is only information about the recipient of that action, the subject of the action, not the person creating the action. So all these things that you're saying are true, but all it does is say, give us information about the world. It doesn't give us a drop of information about God. Here we're talking about what is causing all of this action that's happening in the world. It is God. In what mode? What is the motivation? The answer is none of the above. It's something that we totally cannot relate to. And that's really not such a hard thing. As I said, a blind person can't understand light. It has nothing to do with religion. When you're in high school and the teacher says that one of two options, either space doesn't end or space does end. If space doesn't end, the kid raises his hand. How do you mean it doesn't end? When it does, just keeps going for, what does it mean? You can't conceptualize that. And it's worse if he says space does end. So then what's beyond? And when the scientists tell us that time is just relative, we have no conception of things above time and space. That has nothing to do with Yiddishkeit. It has to do with simple arithmetic. We also know that God, as the creator, existed before time and space. Which means that even without any Rambams or Ramchals, it's clear that we would have no conception of Hashem. The only thing is that we are now clarifying for ourselves what that means. We have no conception of Hashem means literally no conception. We should not fool ourselves into thinking that we do. Rambam says, this is very important, because if somebody has the wrong conception of Hashem, it's just like you're believing in the wrong God. You know the story of Nachman Breslov in the Misnagdim? Rav Nachman, how does he explain the Misnagdim? They're such choshev yidden, they're against you. Rav Nachman says, me, the Misnagdim, they have nothing against me. They have something against that person who they think I am. And he deserves it. Is that me? And similarly, the Rambam says that if a guy believes that God has emotions, God is not a kulay poshut, that all these things about God he believes differently, he doesn't believe in God. He believes in some imaginary creation of his own mind that he calls God, but it's not God. He says, Amoshel, if I tell you, a guy asks you, what's an elephant? And you tell him an elephant has three wings, flies in the sky, swims in the sea. An elephant has a face like a human being, talks like a baby. You wouldn't say that such a person has a primitive understanding of an elephant. He just doesn't know what an elephant is. So too, if you believe the wrong things about God, you don't believe in God. You're worshiping idols. You're believing totem poles. That's what the Rambam means, I would imagine, when in Hilchas Tshuva. He's not talking about somebody who believes that God has actual nose with nostrils. There were no people that really believed that. I mean, idol worshippers, nobody who the Ravid is, who could the Ravid be talking about? He must mean that these machloikesin that the Rambam is having with other Rishonim regarding positive attributes, negative attributes, that the Rambam equates, he says it's mamish the same thing. You say God has positive attributes, saying that God has limbs. So that's what the Rambam's referring to, and there the Ravid can say, what are you talking about? The Rishonim that held like that, you know, who are we talking about over here? But to say that means that somebody really believed that God, who on record, who's the Ravid referring to? The Tzaddikim, this, the God has a nose? I mean, they throw him out. Yeah. Yeah, there are two things. Right. There are two things. The question is, what about the scientists that have certain dating methods that they claim to have found items, primarily organic items, that are much more than 5,763 years old? Well, there's two answers. Answer number one is that these things in general are faulty. They're faulty. And they're based on assumptions. But there's something else. Let's say we were alive during the Sheshis Yimei Bereshis. And we wanted to see how old the world is. And a debate ensues. I say the world is 6 days, it's 5 days. Some scientist says it's really 10 million years and whatever. And then some scientists figures out that a tree, every year of its existence, gains another ring around its trunk. So scientists, remember, this is on the sixth day of creation. The world is 6 years, 6 days old. He chops down a tree and he says, look, there are 400 rings there. That's proof the world's 400 years old. So what's wrong with that logic? The answer is the world is 400 years old, but it was created 6 days ago. When God created the world, he created it aged. How long does it take the light of the sun, of the stars, to reach Earth? The light was already there. How long does it take trees to grow? How old was Adam HaRishon, Shemu Shemayim? If somebody said he wasn't born an embryo, he wasn't a baby, he wasn't one day old. Adam HaRishon was born an adult. So let some scientists take some DNA from Adam and figure out that it takes 40 years to reach this level. He'll come out, the world is 40 years old. When the world was created, we already had these insects that live in corroded, degenerated trees. Degenerating trees. We had light, we had stars, we had everything. How old is the world? Maybe the world is 10 million years old, 10 billion years old. I don't know. All I know is it was created 5,763 years ago. How aged is it? I have no idea. Let them say whatever they want. It could be who knows how many years old. So if they find a rock, that they could measure with some scientific method. They can't, but let's say they'll find some scientific method to measure a rock. They'll say, this rock is 10 million years old. Shikoyach scientist. That doesn't answer the question. The question is, when was this 10 million, how long ago was this 10 million year old rock created? Answer, 5,763 years. Can you deal with that question? No, they can't deal with that question. That's it. The world was created. Adam was an adult. He wasn't a 6 day old baby. The whole world was an adult world. How adult? Was it 100 years, 200 years, 2 million years? Whatever he wants. Hashem can, you know, do whatever he wants. But clearly the world was not just created 1 day old. Any other questions? Then we'll have a good night. The odds of this world coming by accident, even after the billions and quadrillions years, like the monkey on the typewriter, are billions and billions, billions of times less than two fingerprints and two snowflakes and 100 witnesses lying. But you would say, well, I'm not going to risk eating chaza because of that. To kill a guy, send him to the electric chair, easy, you would. But not eating chaza, no. Nobody ever taught me. Hello, Mr. Atheist. I gave you enough brains, Hashem said. You should figure it out on your own. And the same with those other religions. That religion. The Yoshka is the Son of God. Son of God. Yoshka is the Messiah. Messiah has to come paternally from King David. And at the beginning of the New Testament, believe it or not, they have a whole Yichas brief of Yoshka all the way up to King David. Yeah, don't believe it, but that's what it has there. Now, hello, as a Christian, hello. I thought his father had nothing to do with his birth. So don't laugh. They asked the Pope. I have over here a rabbi. He asked the Pope. Basically, the Pope said, the Vatican, they sent some representative, said, it's not really true. The stories aren't really true. The religion is, you know, it's nice, Mishalim, but it's not really true. There's no way out. A religion. Listen to this. Imagine Christianity. Imagine this. God told everybody, all the Jews on Har Sinai, Anoichi Hashem v'lo yielecha, right? Maybe a few million of them were there, correct? Everybody, I am God, this is what I want you to do. Now, a long while later, a number of centuries later, God decides to change the whole picture. You have an Old Testament, you have a New Testament, instead of an Old Testament. God doesn't come again and make a new mass revelation. Instead, God sends an angel to whisper into the ear of this guy Joseph, right, this supposed grandson of David HaMelech who had nothing to do with his son's birth, and said, you know, your wife, your pregnant wife came back, it's really it's from Hashem and this, and he's going to be Yoshka. Now Yoshka comes out and says to the world, whoever follows this Old Testament that God told everybody to follow, he's going to burn, and you have to follow me. Imagine a guy in China. God, how am I supposed to know? You told Yoshka, you didn't tell me. God didn't even tell Yoshka. It never says once that God spoke to Yoshka. Yoshka never even claimed to be speak to God. But you gave the whole world a mass revelation. it's such an evil God. Listen. And then you whisper in the ear of one person, shh, everybody who listens to me, they're going to burn. You know the truth now. There's no way you can communicate it to the whole world. Does that make any sense? The whole religion doesn't make any sense. So a guy's going to come, well, God, you know, I was a Christian and I believed in Yoshka and everything, and it's not going to fly. Everybody has a moral obligation to be honest with themselves, and this is very dishonest, and that's the answer to these people. How could we fault them for not learning? We could fault them for not having seichel, you know? They may have not learned the first four Shulchan Aruchs, first four volumes, but the fifth volume they definitely had access to, and that's what they're responsible for. The rest of it, whatever they're not responsible for, they're not going to be punished for. This much, yes. Any other questions? We'll call it a night. Well, that we said that's machlokes. There are those that say that he's yoytze the mitzvah of emunah just as a mitzvah min hamufchar. There are those that say he's not yoytze the mitzvah of emunah. Oh wow, look, that's very nice. And the reason is because simply, what if a guy goes to shul every day and he thinks that Buddha is God? And he doesn't believe in God. What if he doesn't believe in God? What if he believes in the wrong? What if he believes Buddha is God?
We're talking about the shul every day. He believes in God. But a number of items that you said.
I know some people, they go all the time to the shul and they don't believe in God. They believe in someone else.
It's the wrong God.